it's not just the brilliance of the technique or of the colours, but the whole conception. And it's very, very mesmerising. We wonder, what is she thinking of? What is behind the facade, so to speak, of her face?
The dancers, who were thankfully funding our delightful, spectacular Olympic piece of harmony and sporting. I think it was probably about banking and soft drinks, but you know, that was just the impression I got from it.
Hello and welcome to this week's Oxcast. I'm Alwyn Collinson.
And I'm Ash Bond. This weekend it is Art in Action, an annual artistic extravaganza held at Waterperry Gardens. Have you heard about Art in Action?
Well, I have now, because I've just heard about it from you. Actually, I was informed about it by my grandparents, who are going along, yeah. But don't let that put you off. They're lovely people, honestly.
There's quite a spectrum of people going. There's lots of stuff for kids. There's lots of stuff.
I hear there's beekeeping on display, which I'm really quite curious about, because I'm wondering how the hell you get them to stay, you know, where you want them to. You've got some red-hot insider info on this, haven't you?
I do have some red-hot insider info. I spoke to Geoffrey Courtney, one of the artists who'll be demonstrating there. Now, Geoffrey's been attending Art in Action since 1977, and I was told by Anna, one of the organisers, that if there was anything that we needed to know about Art in Action, then Geoffrey was the one to talk to.
Okay.
People who might not have heard of it, can you tell us a little bit more about Art in Action, Geoffrey?
What it is the idea behind it was to bring artists and the public together, and in such a way that people can see how people make things. So say you're a furniture maker or something like that. It's like you bring your workshop to Art in Action, and you carry on making furniture. But people are there, can come up to you, see you, and say, how do you do that? Or why do you do this? And you answer the questions. And so people can watch artists at work, artists and craftsmen, and see how they do things, ask questions, or just watch them work.
There's a glimpse inside the artist's studio in a way, isn't it?
It's like me taking my studio, transporting it to the tent in Oxfordshire, setting up again, and then carrying on painting. And then people come along and they say, what do you do? And I answer the questions, and all people just watch. So quite often I find that I'm working away and I suddenly sort of turn around and there's 10, 15 people just standing behind me watching. And they're quite interested to just watch you getting on with it. It's a thing that people don't have a chance to do very often. To watch a jeweller actually making a ring, or a painter painting a still life or something. You know, you don't get to see them in their studio usually. So Art in Action kind of makes that possible.
And we've got some really interesting exhibitors this year, haven't we? I mean, you always have very interesting exhibitors, but I read on the website that you've got a tent makers from Cairo coming. Yeah. And that sounds amazing.
It is an extraordinary event. I mean, both from its scale and the quality. Quite often, if it gets too big, it doesn't have the sort of quality or the intimacy. But Art in Action has retained the most amazing standard of any of these types of shows, easily the best in England, in my view anyway. So I tell you, one of the best ways to understand what the show has to offer is if you go to the front lawn, right in front of the house. You go right in front of Waterperry House, which is a lovely house, and you go in, there are various concerts and lectures in the house. But on the front lawn, there's a tent called The Best of the Best. And it means that every artist has submitted one work to go in that exhibition. And so it's a best piece from every single demonstrator at the event in that tent.
Fantastic.
So if you go into the best tent, it's like having a microcosm of all that's available in the show. And then you can go around that and you might say, well, I wonder what jewellery they've got here. So you go around, you look at the jewellery exhibitions, and then on each exhibit there will be a label which says, this artist is so-and-so, you can see them in such and such a tent. And so that way you get a feel for what the show has to offer if you've never been before.
What a brilliant way of navigating the show.
Yeah, it is. It is. Good idea.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey, for talking to us today.
Pleasure. Hope to see you then.
Takes place this weekend, the 19th, the 22nd of July.
God, he was well informed, wasn't he? What about other things in the art world this week in Oxford?
Well, many will be aware of the Ashmolean Museum's campaign to keep Manet's portrait of Mademoiselle Klaus. You may have seen the Save the Manet posters or even the copies of the portrait popping up around town. The one outside St. Mary's, I don't know if you've noticed recently, has acquired some rather spectacular spectacles.
Yes, when I went past there, she also had a beard and moustache, and I was looking at it thinking, this Manet, I'm not sure about his taste in models, you know. But it is trying to be saved for the public, isn't it? Try to keep it
indeed,
in Oxford.
Yeah. I went to the Ashmolean earlier this week to talk to one of the collection's curators, Colin Harrison, and to Joe Rice from the Education Department. Hello, Colin. If you could tell us a little bit about the importance of the painting to the Ashmolean and the history of the painting itself as well.
Well, the painting by Manet of Mademoiselle Klaus, the portrait of Mademoiselle Klaus, comes at a key moment in his career in 1868, and it is a preparatory study for the balcony, which is in the Musée d'Orsay, which is one of the great monuments of Impressionist art, which he finished in 1869. And our research on the picture has discovered, I think, has uncovered that it's really the first version of the balcony, all that remained. Manet had this habit of cutting things up. If you go to the National Gallery, you'll see the execution of Maximilian, four bits thereof that were reassembled by Degas after Manet's death. And similarly, the portrait of Mademoiselle Klaus was, I think, much bigger on the right-hand side and at the top, and it's been cut down. And Manet himself had it in his possession in the present state in a frame, and it's recorded as such after his death. It is one of his most brilliant and vivid works. I mean, there are few paintings that really you look at and they slap you in the face. They're just so extraordinary, and this is one of them. It's not just the brilliance of the technique or of the colours, but the whole conception, and it's very, very mesmerising. We wonder, what is she thinking of? What is behind the facade, so to speak, of her face? And this is something that, when the balcony, the bigger picture in the Musée d'Orsay, was exhibited in 1869, the critics immediately seized upon. What was Manet doing? Was he really trying to explain or to illustrate the alienation of modern life? Because that's one of the key points of the whole of Manet. What was he doing? It's not simply a character study or a portrait of his friend. It is something much more. And Manet is not only one of the greatest artists of the 19th century, but also one of the most enigmatic. And so much has been written about him, and so much is written about him, especially in university departments. This is one of the many reasons why we wanted to have the picture here, that he's endlessly fascinating, both to the general public and to scholars. What exactly did he mean when he was painting all these pictures? And the portrait of Mademoiselle Klaus illustrates, in one of the most attractive and visually stunning fashions, exactly what Manet is about. The Impressionist collection in the Ashmolean depends largely on gifts from the Pissarro family, so it's very Pissarro heavy. We do have one painting by Van Gogh, we do have one painting by Monet, and we do have a handful of paintings by Renoir. But the Manet really transforms what is a good collection into a world-class collection. I mean, this is a picture that will sell itself on postcards from now till Kingdom Come. It really is the most extraordinary picture.
For us in the education team, it provides lots of opportunities because it's an impressionist painting and it's by a really well-known artist. So, you know, lots of people, even if they're not kind of art historians, have heard of Manet. So that's quite handy. So it's Manet, it's an impressionist painter. So you can look at it from that art history point of view. But what's really nice for us in education is it's a portrait. So it's a picture of a person. Mm-hmm. And we know who she is and we know all about her. And so you can compare that with other portraits and human images, even if you don't know who the person is, from sort of ancient history, so you can make connections across our collection. It's a painting of a young woman, and you can explore her life. You can look at what she's wearing, you can look at the setting, you can look at the techniques, because it's an unfinished painting, which initially you might think, well, that's not that helpful to have an unfinished painting. But what's wonderful is you can see the starting point for the artist, you know, creating this artwork, which you don't see when something's finished. You can't see it working. So for art students, whether it's primary school, whether it's secondary art and design, GCSE, foundation art students, then it's a really, really helpful kind of thing to be able to see. So we take it from all sorts of different points of view, from looking at identity, looking at image, looking at the clothing, looking at portraits, and we use that with schools. So that's from early years, so from sort of preschool, 3-4 year olds through to sixth form. With primary schools, we use the painting part of our exploring portrait session. So that is looking at the messages that a portrait communicates about the person. So how you sit, how you are sort of positioning yourself, the expression on your face, the objects you have around you, how you're choosing to be dressed, all of those things communicate messages, and we kind of read those in the painting itself. But we've also used it for art and design sessions, for sketching, for drawing, looking at colour, pattern, texture, comparing and contrasting, imagining the sounds in the painting, imagining what might happen if you could extend the picture and sort of see what might be to the left and to the right and above and below, what she's looking at, what her view might be. So there's lots and lots of potential. We're using it as one of our events during the summer, which is all about kind of making an impression and the techniques of impressionism. So we used it for a huge, huge range. Adult sessions, we've got, you know, talks going on the impressionists or just focusing on that painting. So a real range of opportunities, and, you know, an object you can use as a starting point for so many things.
There we go. The portrait is on temporary display in the museum's Impressionist Gallery until the end of August, and there is a special event centred around the Manet and the Impressionists. It's called Make a Good Impression. Do you see what they did there, Ash?
Yeah.
Where you can apparently make your own mini masterpiece to go take home with you. I think that's a little bit prescriptive, you know. Some people might not want to create a masterpiece, but that's on Wednesday the 8th of August between 1 and 4. So do go down to Geschmolin and decide for yourself. There's plenty going on in the world of theatre in the next couple of weeks. Pegasus Theatre Company are in fact bringing the world to us with the Oxford International Youth Arts Festival, or MESH. So you've been finding out a little bit about that, haven't you, Miranda?
Yes, it's a very interesting initiative. It's a very new arts festival. It gets young people from all over Europe who run theatre groups and dance groups and so on, mm-hmm. Together for a week, and they each bring their own piece, and they tend to be run as double bills twice a day.
Wow.
So there's, for example, on Saturday, there's one from a Grenoble company presenting a piece all based on French narratives from the 12th and 13th centuries.
There's a riveter for you.
And yeah. And a dance piece about reason from Leeds. There's also one I'm quite interested to see is... on Sunday, there's a Netherland chiller about a sort of Dutch version of Will o' the Wisp.
Wow.
These white women that stand around in woodland and lure you in, which sounds quite exciting.
Terrifying. I've had some problems with those.
Well, yeah, you would. and there's also one interesting thing as well. On Wednesday, there's, again, at 4:30 and 8:30 p.m. Most of these are at 4:30 and 8:30 p.m. all week, and you get both plays as a double bill twice, mm-hmm. in one day, but that's it.
You can only see
them on any individual day. But there's one group from Thailand presenting a musical inspired by a Thai epic, Ramakien.
Right.
And another group from Russia presenting a dance show about technology.
These sound fantastically eclectic.
They're,
you know,
really
sort of,
it's
wondrous,
a lovely bundle
in their craziness.
Of crazy things.
And so we've also
actually,
got
yeah.
Croatia in the mix. You know, it
oh,
really
yes,
is
and,
a truly
Baghdad,
international.
Group Baghdad,
Baghdad
yeah.
Wow. So in other words, it's, you know, it's something for everyone.
Exactly. I think I think you'd be able to find something interesting. They're all either theatre or dance.
Right.
It's all organised by young people from these theatre groups yeah. worldwide. And on Saturday, in the centre of town, they're going to do a street theatre procession.
Fantastic.
With all of them together.
What time is that at?
That's at 5 p.m. It's free. It starts around Carfax. And, yeah, so you can sort of go along and watch them do
that. That sounds amazing.
Probably fairly improvised street theatre. All the plays cost either £7 or £5 for concessions. Most of them are at Pegasus, but they're also partnered with the North Wall Arts Centre in Summertown, so some of them are there. And all the details, as usual, are on our website.
Brilliant. Well, it is also summer, of course, and we have brave troops of actors risking the rain to bring us Shakespeare in the outdoors. So Creation Theatre are going to be performing Merchant of Venice in the Said Business School's Amphitheatre until the 26th of August, and Shakespeare's Globe is on tour and is performing Hamlet in the Bodleian until this Sunday, the 22nd of July. If you're more in the mood for a comedy, then the Oxford Theatre Guild are performing Much Ado About Nothing in Trinity College Gardens until Saturday. Love, betrayal, feminist ire, and a splash around in a fountain is one of my favourites.
I was lucky enough to see Peter and Donnie play the charming and slightly cantankerous Benedict in the play.
Much Ado About Nothing has been performing in Trinity Gardens since Tuesday. How have the performances been going so far?
Pretty good, yeah. We've managed to get post-productions outside, which is great. But we do have an indoor venue just in case the weather is a bit too bad. We've only been here a couple of times now, which is pretty good.
Oh, that is good. And I heard the rain has held off so far, so that's a positive thing. Much Ado About Nothing is one of my favourite plays. But for people who aren't quite so familiar with the play, what might we expect from this production?
Well, I'm right with you there. It's one of my favourite plays as well, which is why I wanted to do it so much. But it starts off as one of Shakespeare's more light-hearted shows. You know, you don't have to worry about threats or loads of people dying, something like that. But in essence, it is a love story. There are two love stories going on throughout, and a lot of laughs to be had. The cast have worked insanely hard at it, and I think they've had some pretty good results. It's a, you know, fun one that the whole family can see. That sounds a bit corny, but that's what Shakespeare wrote, and that's what it is.
Well, he was writing for everyone, wasn't he? We had a really positive review of the production on the site by Helen Mills, and at one point she mentioned in her review that one of the cast jumps into a fountain in the production. Is that quite Branner-inspired?
Yeah, I imagine there probably was a little bit of inspiration there. The problem with doing any Shakespeare play is that, you know, when they've been going for about 400 or 500 years, it's very difficult to find something that has never been done. I don't want to give too much away, so I'm just going to leave it at that, I think.
Great. Thank you very much for talking to us, Kieran.
Thank you. Bye.
You can read Helen Mills' review on our website, www.dailyinfo.co.uk. Remember, it plays whatever the weather.
In the last podcast, we were talking about the Olympics and the preparations for the Torch event. Now, a couple of days ago, Ash and I talked to Ben Lafferty, who's a resident of Cowley Road, about whether the reality matched the hype.
So last week, it was the Olympic Torch in Oxford.
Yes.
And did the Daily Info staff watch it from our balcony, watched it go past?
Yeah.
The Torch preceded by the Coca-Cola truck.
Yeah.
And the Samsung trucks.
And the Lloyd's TSB truck.
Yeah. Well, I was in the press bit at the Torch in the South Parks, and we got to see the Lloyd's TSB dancers, who were thankfully funding our delightful spectacular of Olympic peace and harmony and sporting. I think it was probably about banking and soft drinks, but, you know, that was just the impression I got from it. What did you think, Ben?
I was a bit put off, I have to say, that we spent about 45 minutes waiting for the Torch itself to come along. Then we were told it would arrive. We spent that time, as you say, looking at cheerleaders. There was a unicyclist provided by the Lloyd's TSB Corporation, which was very enjoyable. And then we were told by the people in Olympic jackets, so the people who were involved with the Torch rather than the corporate side, we were told that we were going to be on television very soon, so we should all be smiling and clapping. And they hadn't told us that the reason for that was that there were cameras loaded onto the backs of those corporate vehicles that were going to pass us, and they were going to try and use that footage in advertising materials, promotional materials. So we weren't, in fact, they didn't care whether we enjoyed or clapped or laughed for the Olympic Torch, but for TSB and Samsung. So I understand that money has to come from somewhere.
Of course, yeah.
So that's the reality of the situation.
In a sense, it's a bigger issue than just Oxford celebration itself.
Indeed,
so
yeah.
Maybe a few words about how we think it went down in the celebration in Oxford, about how it affected the city.
Mm.
I, for one, was really surprised that they didn't choose to go through the centre of the city, where we've got all these amazing historic buildings, we've got the colleges, we've got the libraries. You know, I would have thought it'd be a fantastic backdrop for historic event.
Indeed, and if you compare it to the footage from Cambridge,
yeah.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
But then again, I mean, Cowley is where the majority of people live, perhaps, in these sort of areas.
Well, as a resident of Cowley Road, I would suggest that maybe you get a better overall impression of Oxford if you go through Cowley than if you go through some other parts of the city.
Well, it doesn't have to be either or. We could have gone over the bridge, you know. But I did feel a little bit jealous that Cambridge got to take the torch along in a punt, and we just got it along Cowley Road. I love Cowley Road. Cowley Road's fantastic. Yeah. But, you know, there are two sides to the city.
Indeed. And it was great to have the community out there, wasn't it?
It was good.
That was, I think, probably the best thing for me about the Olympic Tour celebrations was
Absolutely. Seeing
all of those hundreds and thousands of people at the side of the road all together. Mm. And the little kids with the Union Jack flags that were
yes.
wrapped around them, high-fiving the policemen as they were yeah. getting past.
That was a nice touch, yes. I did like that Thames Valley Police did actually put out, like, on Twitter and on their website and stuff, saying, if you see a policeman with the Olympic torch today, give them a high-five,
yeah.
like, sort of stuff. It was that sort of... The little touches seemed well done. The overall organisation, though, I mean, as a community resident, Ben, like, what sort of feel have you got from people? How do you think people reacted to having this event here, particularly replacing Cowley Road Carnival?
Well, okay, so that's almost two separate questions.
Mm.
The first answer is positive, I think. Mm. I was out on the street. I live up by the Mansell Way Resource Centre. Mm. And I have to say, the pavement was full of people. There were local merchants selling cupcakes. It seemed to be very good for
yeah.
them, which was pleasing. There were all sorts of people being drawn from the community. Obviously, we're next to a very big mosque. Many people came out from the mosque to see the mm. celebration. So that's all very pleasing. The second point, though, about the Cowley Road Festival, I think many, many people are going to miss that.
Mm.
That's something I look forward to in the year. It's nice to see the local businesses come out onto the pavements. I think that's an opportunity that was missed. I don't know why in the longer day of the Olympic torch celebrations, they couldn't have incorporated some of the things we traditionally associate with the Cowley Road Festival, like the sort of the street carnival atmosphere.
Absolutely.
Which I think was sort of lost in the melee of the corporate sponsors.
Yeah,
and
that is a very good point, yeah.
We were really lucky in that we did manage to get tickets for the South Park event mm-hmm. as well, and I know a lot of people didn't.
There were a lot of very disgruntled people outside South Parks.
That's interesting. Although, of course, you know, they were giving away by postcode, but someone did point out to me South Parks was nowhere near
no,
full.
Not
I mean,
at all.
Obviously, you know, there are safety issues. I imagine they did have kind of hard limits on that sort of stuff. But if you think about the number of people who flood in, for example, for the fireworks celebrations,
yeah.
you certainly could have fitted
yeah.
more people
How
in.
How many
there.
Tickets were issued?
I don't know the exact numbers. I think it was around 20,000.
There were nowhere yeah. near 20,000 people.
I no. couldn't imagine they would have been.
I just imagine that a lot of people, especially because it was so hyped up so far in advance,
yeah.
put in their requests early and then just didn't turn up,
yeah.
which is deeply unfortunate.
And you could get 4 tickets per household as well, couldn't
yeah,
you? So
exactly.
I think if you applied for them, you would have just applied for 4.
Mm-hmm.
So the actual celebrations themselves in South Park, I mean, I caught some of the later ones.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't catch the earlier 5:30 to 7:30
yeah.
then because I was out watching the torch. And I heard there were Young Guns there.
Yep, I was there, I saw it. I was talking a little bit with the BBC there, and they were having Young Guns. They had Twist and Pulse, who are Britain's Got Talent finalists. They
sponsored
were
sponsored by Samsung,
and they weren't going to let you forget it. We did have several points where Twist or possibly Pulse, Twist and Pulse perhaps, got out their Samsung mobiles, which they were happy enough to tell us the serial numbers of, and you know, the make and model, to let us know that we could go and buy it online. And they took photos of the crowd and then projected it onto the high definition screens behind them. Again, you know, that we're edging back into the corporate sponsorship thing, but, you know, there were a lot of things there. There was stuff going on. There was also, like, Out of the Blue, the Oxford a cappella singers. They had some folk musicians playing. There was stuff going on. But I got to say, I did think that there was not enough entertainment for the number of people, even with the small number of people who were actually there. People complained about having to traipse along literally the entire length of the park. The LOCOG, the official Olympic stage was set up at the extreme end of the park. And all of the other stuff, all of the council-sponsored folk tents and things were literally at the other end of the park, at the right bottom.
And I really enjoyed those, actually. I was there for most of the later part of the evening, until, of course, the Tree of Light, which happened at 9:30. Now, the Tree of Light had been going up for a week previously, maybe 10 days, and we've seen this sort of huge scaffolding going up, and we talked on last week's podcast to Steve, one of the project managers of the project. And it did look spectacular from the far back in the crowd where I was. And the structure itself, it was well lit. It looked gorgeous. But I unfortunately wasn't one of the perhaps few people that could get to the front.
Well, we're lucky enough to have.
Indeed, we've got
someone who had sharp elbows. I did manage to get a...
You can't see them, but they're vicious.
Yes, yeah. I did manage to... my partner and I did manage to get to near the front. And so I managed to get, I think, a better view of it than a lot of people did. I would point out that this is a problem with the Tree of Light. And I don't know if it's a problem with the Tree of Light, or rather it's a problem with the setting. If you can picture South Park, it was set up sort of towards the bottom of the park, and so theoretically what should have happened is you'd have a natural amphitheatre where people are looking down from the slope onto the stage, and everybody I think had a very good view of the huge sort of monolith that Ashley has described. However, there was choreographed dancing going on just in front of the stage, which if you weren't in sort of the first three or four rows of people, it was almost impossible to see. And so half the effect of it, I think, was lost for plenty of people in the crowd. And I've spoken to a lot of people who didn't even know dancing was going on in front of the stage. And that's a shame. I think it's probably worth pointing out that you maybe didn't miss half the thing if you couldn't see the dancing. It was performed, I believe, by local school children.
Yeah.
Is that right? So it was... it was great to see that the community was getting involved and local school children were being able to perform in front of thousands of people. The choreography was naturally quite limited. The choreography relied for the most part on the fact that they had these quite mesmerising sticks with sort of fluorescent lights on the top.
I did see those.
Yes, I think they were one of the few things that people could see.
Yeah.
And there were flares like you would get in an Italian football match towards the end, which are kind of exciting. I will say that I found myself in the position of being sort of a Tree of Life apologist. I quite enjoyed it, and I was in a crowd of people who were basically affronted by it, who thought it was dreadful. So one of the really telling comments I heard in the crowd was that people said, "Oh, I wish they'd done something interesting, like fireworks." And for someone who doesn't find fireworks particularly interesting, I thought that was a very telling comment. I think the position to arrive at the Tree of Life from was the one I did, which was a position of perfect ignorance. Mm. I didn't know what to expect. And as such, I was sort of dazzled by the very impressive monolith. The monolith was aesthetically interesting because it was a mixture of the industrial and the organic. So it looked like some kind of dystopian future building.
That's exactly where they were going.
That was literally there.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Okay, but it was also it had sort of plants incorporated in it, and I believe I don't know because I couldn't see it very clearly. Was it powered by cyclists inside?
Yeah,
pedal power.
There were cyclists in little lighted booths in it. Yeah. They must have been absolutely sweating, I got to say, because they were pedalling for the whole thing. I think it's so interesting though that you came from this kind of, because I believe Ash and I were both, you know, we were kind of looking at the event details in advance because we were there sort of hyping it up, and it did sound amazing. You know, it sounded like at the very least a lot of work had been put into it. Mm-hmm. And then, like you said, it came along, and one thing I did notice was there was a stream, like literally a deluge of people leaving the back of the crowd.
Yes.
And the sides, and indeed the middle of the crowd. People, like you said, people couldn't see, and in fact I think it was exacerbated by the fact that they were, you say, children. I was standing quite near the front also, and I almost couldn't see anything because there were rows and rows of presumably parents. Mm-hmm. I hope they were parents because mm-hmm. they were taking photographs of the kids, you know, raising their arms up, and you could not see on earth what was going on.
Yeah.
And I thought it was so interesting that there obviously so much work and probably a lot of money has mm-hmm. gone into a big collaborative project. They had a 1,000 performers, over 1,000 mm-hmm. performers.
I think it's reaching a million the price of the performance.
Wow, really? And no one could see it.
Yeah. Yeah, so when you consider all that was for the benefit of probably a few dozen, maybe a couple of hundred people who actually had a view, yeah. That's worth telling. I think if we're going to say positive things about it, because I think there are positive things
there
to
are.
Say.
Yeah.
I actually thought if you came to it and you enjoyed it from the perspective of a world fusion music concert,
mm.
I thought that the music was... It was that kind of quite bland music that you always get at these sort of civic celebration events. But for all that, it was very good.
Oh yeah.
The choir was excellent. The band were very proficient. You know, there were I think the people who were getting into it were treating it like you would treat a big outdoor gig.
Sure.
As opposed to a sort of community art spectacular event. Mm. And I think if you went into it with those expectations, then you were bound to be disappointed. I will say also in its defence, because I found myself defending it a lot, I will say for the record, I find it mildly enjoyable, but I think I enjoyed it more than most other people.
Yeah.
That if you wanted fireworks or a Wicker Man, this was obviously going to disappoint you, but I did actually think it was much more... It was a much more ambitious thing to do than to sort of go to one of those old standbys.
It's less obviously spectacular, isn't it?
Yes.
And in that way, it's kind of... They're trying to do something more complex.
Yeah, and it... Although the message that it was presenting was very ham-fisted and simplistic, at least it had more to say than a fireworks show. I mean, it was saying some things about the environment and saying some things about diminishing resources. Mm. There was one piece of choreography that was actually probably the best part, which I read as a sort of a war going on over the world's diminishing resources that actually was thought-provoking. But I suspect that by that point, most people had tuned out of trying to interpret anything in the show. That's not their fault. I think that was a fault of the organisation and where it was located. Somebody made a suggestion as to why it couldn't have been, and I suspect I know the reason, it would have been difficult to physically do it, but why it couldn't have been put higher up in the park.
Mm.
So instead of having the amphitheatre that I talked about, people looking down and therefore having an obstructed view, why couldn't it have gone right up at the top of the hill?
Yeah.
And then maybe people would have gotten a better view of the choreography.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's
so
very true.
Very mixed reactions there too.
I think it's kind of a common theme for the entire event, isn't mm-hmm. it? That it was, you know, good concept, good ideas, and everyone got behind it, but then let down by poor execution.
Yes.
Although I did find it interesting, I was speaking to someone who's touring around with the Olympic torch and is seeing all of the different celebrations organised by all of the communities around the country. She said that this was one of the best she had seen in the rest
really?
In the whole country. Yeah, I mean, that was a little earlier in the day, so maybe the disappointment of the Tree of Light hadn't yet set in yet. But I think it only goes to show, you know, that at the very least, we seem to have picked up one of the better events.
Well,
countrywide.
I'd also say as well, it's worth pointing out that a lot of that comes from the fact that Oxford has a much better infrastructure for these kinds of public celebrations than most other cities do. I mean, a lot of what was enjoyable for me about the event in the park was the folk stage. The ladies dancing around that sort of skull teapot thing that I've seen before, but I never quite know what it is. And so we have to give a lot of credit, not just to the external people who came in and did the Tree of Life, but also the local community people.
Absolutely.
Who make these events really good year on year.
Mm-hmm. They had local food stalls, things like that. You know, that was, I agree, that was the shining heart of it.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you very much, Ben.
That's my pleasure.
So that's all for this week. Thank you to Ben, Joe, Colin and Jeffrey. That's goodbye from all of us here at the Daily Info office.
No thanks to me, I see. It's all right. I'll take these stings and arrows with a hard, hard hash. Remember to check out our website, www.dailyinfo.co.uk, or follow us on Twitter, @DailyInfoOxford, for news of our next podcast and for events around Oxford.